Side 6, An Agent in Place by Robert Little, continuing on page 205. Once again, he estimates having eradicated all traces of between a dozen and 15 messages. Of these, he was able to reconstruct the contents of 5 messages with a degree of accuracy. 2 of the 5 messages supplied Ironweed with technical support. Filipov cut in. Lists of dead drops in Moscow, code names for each, addresses in Western Europe where he could send innocent-looking picture postcards alerting his handlers that he was depositing something in a particular dead drop, that sort of thing. A third message, Glebova continued, asked his handlers if they could get him and his family out of the Soviet Union in the event he felt that the KGB was closing in on him. Apparently there is a wife, a child, on what Ironweed called his doomsday list, though there is no indication of the sex of the child or its age. A fourth message, apparently sent in 1971, attempted to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of various members of the Politburo, and suggest who was likely to succeed Brezhnev as the general secretary of the party if he were to die. Once again, Andropov's name plays a prominent role. Ironweed appeared to be convinced that Andropov stood a good chance of stepping into the number one slot despite reformist tendencies. Ironweed also appears to have believed that his star would rise within the superstructure as Andropov's star rose. Whoever Ironweed was, Filipov asserted with vehemence, he was known and liked by Andropov. Andropov knew hundreds of people, the general remarked sourly. Of the hundreds, he may have liked half of them. He shook his head in exasperation. You said the American was able to reconstruct 5 messages. The 5th message is very curious, Glebova confessed. Very curious, Filipov repeated to himself. Up to this point, the Americans had been careful never to contact Ironweed directly. Everything was done through cutouts, like Silverweed, or through the use of dead drops. Then, during the summer of 1971, Ironweed, for some reason, insisted on talking to one of his American handlers. Someone was brought into the country as part of a delegation of environmentalists. Ironweed managed to pick him up in his car and take him for a long drive, during which Ironweed tried to convince his interlocutor that the Americans must increase their military expenditures year after year in order to force the Russians to keep pace. His point was that the Russians, unlike the Americans, could not afford both guns and butter at the same time. That the economy would crack, Filipov explained, bringing on the objective conditions needed to install a reformer as head of the party. We have seen this analysis of the American motives before, the general observed. Why do you characterize this message as curious? What was curious, Filipov answered for Glebova, was an incident, described by the American author of the message, that took place while Ironweed was driving along a country road. They came across a tractor that had broken down and was blocking the road. According to his American companion, Ironweed got out of the car, rolled up his sleeves, and proceeded to repair the tractor's engine. He removed a diesel filter and cleaned it. He purged air from a fuel line. He replaced everything and started the motor. The tractor driver laughingly told Ironweed that with such a skill, he could get a job running a tractor collective. Filipov's eyebrows arched in an agony of revelation. You do see where this is going. Ironweed is clearly an apparatchik, a member even of the elite nomenklatura, working out of the superstructure. He wears a tie and a jacket when he goes to the office. He probably has a secretary. He probably has underlings. He knows Andropov, may even consider himself a protege of sorts, yet he can lift the hood of a tractor and repair the engine. Remember the Kalmyk who probably came from the Stavropol Krai, Glebova said, articulating each word. The old general shook his head in frustration. Probably this, probably that. Ironweed probably went to a university, probably had a Czech friend who probably had an important party post in Prague, probably was married, probably had a child when he asked the CIA to organize an emergency escape route, probably knew Andropov, probably was promoted, assuming he did not die, in 1985. Probably had a friend who was a Kalmyk. Probably was in Moscow in 1967 and in Prague in 1969. Probably was in Brussels and a KGB sanatorium on the Black Sea at some point in his life, and probably had worked on a collective farm when he was young. How else could he have known how to repair a tractor engine? The general's shoulders heaved. Turning to his son-in-law for the first time, he asked, Tell me, Victor, how many people were promoted to positions of authority when the government changed in 1985? Several thousand, at least. Of these, how many do you think had a wife and one child? How many would have been acquainted with Andropov? Instead of responding to the general's question, Victor addressed Glebova. You have left out the business of Marlow. Glebova stiffened. I did not omit it, she said in her plodding voice. I was saving the best for the last. She studied her notes to refresh her memory, then looked up at the general. Before being posted to Prague, the American Bassett was given his instructions by a person who pretended to be a State Department security officer and who went by the name of Marlow. Bassett gave our colleagues from the Second Chief Directorate a physical description of the man. He was said to be in his late 40s or early 50s, physically big to the point of being fat. He was said to move with incredible grace, almost like a ballet dancer. He was said to have thin, prematurely gray hair and uneven teeth and talk with a Texas accent. He was said to rarely smile. When he did smile, he looked, according to the American Bassett, as if he were in pain. Filipov impatiently cut in. The description fits the man who ran the CIA station in Prague from 1967 to 1975. He went under the name of Asher Spink. Spink, it would seem, was the case officer who ran the original Silverweed operation. When Silverweed recruited Ironweed, he ran both of them. Spink slipped into Moscow during the summer of 1971 as a member of a group of environmentalists. The Second Chief Directorate was aware of his identity, but decided to let him into Russia in order to see whom he contacted. He was followed everywhere he went. His room in the Hotel Ukraine was seeded with microphones. On the third day of his visit, he disappeared during a conference with environmentalists from the Forestry Ministry. He excused himself to go to the bathroom, then wandered by seeming mistake into a ladies' toilet. The operative who was assigned to him decided it would be too conspicuous to follow him. Spink never emerged. It turned out that the ladies' toilet, unlike the men's toilet, had a door leading to a storage room, and the storage room in turn had a door leading to another corridor. For how long did Spink drop from sight? The general rasped, for once openly intrigued. For 7.5 hours, Glebova noted breathlessly. How do you interpret the significance of the disappearance of the Prague station chief? The general inquired. He managed to convey the feeling that he was posing the question for the record, that he had already glimpsed the response. The rain hammered against the general's window. Glebova's lips parted slightly as she sucked in air. It is a corroborating detail, she whispered emotionally. It is the first thing mentioned in the Ironweed file of eradicated messages that we can say with objective certainty really happened. Ironweed asked for a face-to-face meeting. Spink slipped into the country, then he disappeared for half a day. Filipov pressed his eyes closed. We think it can be said with certitude, he announced in a voice that seemed to take its cadence from the beat of the rain against the window. Somewhere in the upper echelons of the party, the Americans have planted an agent in place, a traitor to the motherland known to his CIA handlers as Ironweed. You must have heard the story, the old general muttered to Victor. It was 3:30 in the morning. They were driving back from the meeting of the Pamyat Directorate, which had been held in an Orthodox church outside a small village 40 kilometers from Moscow. The church had been used as a barn by the villagers for decades and only recently was cleaned and disinfected in preparation for restoration work. Despite this, it still smelled faintly of manure, and traces of the odor had clung to the clothing of Victor and the general. Victor worked the windshield wipers several times to clear away the early morning humidity which accumulated on the window like a film of tears. By all means, tell it, Victor said to his father-in-law. The old man's voice rasped out of the darkness. It seems that the Czechists had been interrogating some Yid, but could not break him. When they reported this to Stalin, he posed the following question. How much does the state weigh? The Czechists were confused. They asked Stalin what he meant by the question. I ask precisely what I mean, Stalin said. And he repeated the question, how much does the state, its buildings, its factories, its sports stadiums, its highways, its trains, its trucks, its ships, its tanks, weigh? So much, said the Czechists, that it would be impossible to calculate. Then Stalin, who knew how to break a yid, who had broken his share in his day, told them, use it. The old general laughed gruffly. The laugh transformed itself into a hacking cough. He hauled an enormous handkerchief from his inside breast pocket and smothered the cough in it. When he was able to talk again, he said, the higher you mount in the superstructure in your search for ironweed, the better it will be for Panya. Use the weight of the state if you have to. Only find him. Chapter 23. The rough floor planks around the writing table were littered with crumpled sheets of paper torn from the lined grade school notebook in which Aida composed poetry. She was trying to work out a poem on the subject of schizophrenia. The theme had been in her head for weeks. Only someone with a split personality could cope with the schizophrenic aspects of reality. After a dozen false starts, a first stanza appeared full-blown behind her shut lids. She opened her eyes and wrote it down in the thick, slanted script she used when she recorded her poems. Fingering Akhmatova's agate ring that had failed to banish fear, she read the stanza out loud. Before the wave breaks a stillness, drifts of water pile up against the crest. Ben, playing dominoes with Sava on the front porch of the dacha, heard her through the open door. Sounds as if you are getting somewhere, he called. Aida was not at all sure she was getting anywhere, with her poetry, with her life. Studying the stanza again, she decided it perfectly described her mental state. The world around her was utterly still. Things were in their place. Her father was sinking slowly toward death in the unheated hospital room. Sava got his proper dose of pills. She had her lover in her bed. And yet, embracing Benedict the night before on the bearskin rug in front of the fire that had burned down to embers, her body glowing like the embers from the rough friction of their lovemaking, she had become aware of the mass of water piling up against the crest. She had sensed the shadow of the wave looming over her. She had become, like her father before her, permanently frightened. Without going into details, Ben had promised her that he had solved their problems. Twice a week, he slipped her a sealed envelope thick with folded slips of paper, and she made her way to the awful street, to the awful building, to the awful room, and delivered the envelope to the awful man with tobacco-stained teeth, and accepted from him the pills Sava needed to stay alive. You will see, Ben had whispered, drawing her warm body against his warm body on the bearskin. Things will end well. Sava will get his operation, and we will have a new incarnation in this incarnation. Swear it, Aida had challenged. Ben had raised his right hand. I swear it. We will live happily ever after. The Romans put a hand on their testicles when they took an oath. Ben had thought she was joking, but had seen from her expression that she was deadly serious. Smiling uncomfortably, he had placed his hand on his testicles. Her fingers had closed over his. I swear it, he had repeated softly. Seeing the shadow of a doubt in her eyes, he had burst out, What can I say to make you believe me? I believe that you believe what you say, Aida had told him. I am only afraid that you are deceiving yourself. And then there is the other matter. The other matter. The Frenchman Camus somewhere wrote that it is better to suffer certain injustices than to commit them. I have always believed this. We are doing what we have to do in order to survive, Ben had retorted hotly. Concentrating on survival has its dangers, Aida had told him. Name one. The instincts you develop to survive are not necessarily the instincts you need to live and love. Come morning, Aida's fears had ebbed. They had seemed like vague memories of bad dreams. Stripping to the skin at the edge of the lake below the dacha, she and Ben had scrubbed each other with sponges dipped in the still icy water, then had raced each other up the steep hill to the dacha to warm themselves in front of a roaring fire, set to blazing with the addition of new wood on the previous night's embers. Aida had boiled water over the fire and had prepared steaming bowls of oatmeal before waking Sava. After breakfast, Sava and Benedict had started a game of dominoes on the porch while Aida had drowned her fears in poetry. Now feeling as if she had come to a dead end, she glanced at the wristwatch that ran counterclockwise, recalled her Polish lover telling her that if time ran backward, one could go back and undo the future. If only it were so. Smiling ironically, she interrupted the domino game, and the three of them set off on one of their long, meandering walks through the countryside around Zagorsk. With Sava scampering ahead, they made their way past the first scarecrow of the planting season, past two ancient peasants hoeing in a vegetable garden, past birds beating up clouds of dust as they bathed in the dry dirt of the footpath, to the ruins of a church standing like a sentinel on a bluff overlooking the far end of the lake. Ducking under a tangle of vines to get inside, they discovered on one weathered wall the white trace of a large cross that must have hung there for centuries before the Bolsheviks decreed that religion was the opiate of the people. From somewhere outside the ruins came the sound of Sava testing an echo in his high-pitched voice. "Ho, ho!" he cried. "Ho, ho!" the echo replied. Aida, who was not religious in any conventional sense, who had in fact flirted with Tibetan Buddhism when she was younger, crossed herself with large gestures of her bunched fingers, then sank to her knees before the trace of the cross, and rocking forward, touched her forehead to the dirt. "Dear God in heaven," she murmured as Ben looked on curiously. And weaving the Buddhist concept of chud into her imperfect orthodoxy, she offered up a prayer. "So, give me the strength to embrace what I fear in order to better understand how all things in the world are related, and being related, divine." Victor was going over with his two section chiefs the latest nuggets culled from conversations picked up by microphones recently planted in the Jewish speculator's dacha near Zagorsk, when the summons from his father-in-law reached him. Both Glebova and Filipov were with the old general when Victor arrived. Filipov was contemplating his reflection in a window. He did not seem to be displeased with what he saw. Glebova had pulled a chair up to the general's desk and was stabbing a blood-red fingernail at sentences in a report that were already underlined. Her tight skirt had ridden up on her thighs, revealing two thick, knobby knees. She noticed Victor noticing them, and tugged at the hem of her skirt. "Tell him what you have told me," the general instructed her. "Silverweed," Glebova announced dramatically, "is a she." Filipov lectured his reflection in the window. "They referred to Silverweed as he to throw anyone who saw the Prague messages off the scent." Victor wanted to know how they had discovered that Silverweed was a woman. Glebova abandoned a half-hearted attempt to iron out the wrinkles in her skirt with a palm. "The reference was buried in one of the ironweed messages that the American Bassett passed to us last week," she said. She reached across the general's desk and pointed out a paragraph underlined in red. "Sensitive compartmented information cable Delta Zebra, 104 of 4 March 1975. The communication is bigot-listed, which means that the addressee controls dissemination and all copies are numbered. The CIA station chief is passing on a message from Ironweed retrieved from a dead drop. Ironweed is signaling that he has been selected to travel to West Germany as part of a delegation. He wants to see Silverweed when he gets there. Whenever Ironweed referred to Silverweed before, he always used the proper noun." "Silverweed this, Silverweed that," Filipov mumbled from the window. "Now Ironweed slips up," Glebova explained. "He says, ask Silverweed to bring her notes." "Her notes," Filipov called across the room. He snorted with pleasure. "What notes?" Victor inquired. The general fitted his eyeglasses over his ears and read the underlined passage. "Ask Silverweed to bring her notes from the Beatles' lecture on the psychological roots of free enterprise. Also the tract based on the lecture Silverweed published during the spring." "It took us a while," Glebova said breathlessly, "but we managed to identify the Beatle." "It was the nickname," Filipov cut in, "students gave to the famous Professor Usov, Boris Sergeyevich, who was said to have resembled the singer John Lennon of the English pop group known as the Beatles. Usov delivered a series of guest lectures at Moscow State University in the fall of 1954, in which he expounded one of his pet theories. According to him, the efficiency of industrial enterprises should be measured by how much profit they make, and not how many units they produce. At the time Glebova picked up where Filipov had left off, Usov was considered to be a radical reformer, far outside the mainstream. Today, he is seen as one of the gurus of the current leadership's economic policies. Stretching his neck so that his Adam's apple protruded, adjusting the knot in his tie, Filipov reluctantly turned away from the window to face Viktor. The reference to Usov, and most especially the use of his nickname, would seem to place Ironweed at Moscow State University in 1954. His request for Silverweed's notes would seem to suggest that he and Silverweed were fellow students. Or lovers, Glebova chirped in exuberant discovery. Remember how the two of them supposedly talked through the night in Brussels? Filipov indicated with a frown that he was not convinced of his colleague's leap of imagination. If one takes Ironweed's reference to the spring to mean the Prague Spring of 1968, he continued, one finds a tract on the subject of the psychological roots of free enterprise published by the Prague State Publishing House. The tract, Glebova was whispering now, bears the signature of Alexander Dubček. An embassy report dated July 15, 1968, said the tract was ghostwritten by Dubček's speechwriter. And Dubček's speechwriter was... Glebova shuddered with nervous excitement. Filipov finished the sentence for her. A woman named Martina Ilkiv. She was well known in Czechoslovakia during the Prague Spring as one of the architects of what Dubček called socialism with a human face. It was she who was said to have come up with this slogan. Glebova found her voice again. We have been going over the lists of students enrolled in the various disciplines at Moscow State University in the early and mid-1950s. So far, we have been unable to find a trace of a Martina Ilkiv. The general's deeply lined face screwed up in a sour grimace. It irritated him when pieces of a puzzle failed to fit. Glebova said, we have not been able to link the Ilkiv woman to Moscow State University or a particular Russian, but we have been able to establish that she visited Moscow during the winter of 1967 and again during the summer of 1971. The dates Ironweed is supposed to have been contacted by Silverweed. We know that she was in Prague for most of 1969, the date of Ironweed's visit to Prague and meeting with Silverweed. She was also said to have been to Brussels at least a dozen times in the 60s and 70s to visit her younger brother, who had emigrated there in the early 1960s. There is, unfortunately, no record of her having been in West Germany in March or April of 1975, although she was known to have been absent from Prague the last 2 weeks of March. The Ilkiv woman, Filipov continued, emigrated to France in January of 1985, the year the CIA broke off contact with Ironweed. She died of a burst appendix in a Paris hospital in October of that year. What about the reference to Ironweed joining a delegation going to West Germany, Viktor asked Glebova. That must narrow the list of possible Ironweeds considerably. Glebova shook her head carefully. Ironweed unfortunately did not specify the date of the delegation's visit to West Germany. There were 5 delegations dispatched to West Germany in the 2 months following the date of this message. One was cultural, one was political, 3 were trade missions. There were 197 men of rank involved in the 5 delegations. Filipov, smiling slyly, interrupted his colleague from the wall. We have ruled out the possibility of Ironweed being a woman on the theory that few women would be capable of repairing the motor of a tractor. Of these 197 men, Glebova continued, 88 appear to fit the profile we have of Ironweed. She began ticking off items on her fingers, which is to say, they were married and had one child, could have conceivably come into contact with Andropov in the course of their careers and thus could have been summoned to consult with him while he was staying at the KGB sanatorium on the Black Sea. They were in Moscow in 1967 and during the summer of 1971. They visited Prague sometime during the fall of 1969. They had been to Brussels at some point in their lives. Filipov was lecturing his image in the window again. We have decided that any man who ever owned or had the use of a car or a truck might be capable of cleaning a filter and purging air from a fuel line. Thus, our profile of Ironweed does not require him to have worked on a collective farm when he was younger, which leaves the matter of his probable promotion in 1985, the year the Central Intelligence Agency broke off contact with Ironweed, Glebova said. Of our 88 potential Ironweeds, 23 rose in the ranks that year. The bottom line is that you have narrowed the field to 23, Viktor said. At the window, Filipov nodded knowingly at his reflection. On the thick glass surface of the vast desk, the general's deformed fingers slowly curled in on themselves, beckoning Viktor. With his good hand, he picked up a sheet of typed names and offered it to his son-in-law. Viktor approached the desk and took the sheet from the general. As his eyes ran down the list, his lips parted slightly. An almost inaudible whistle seeped from between his teeth. When he finally managed to tear his eyes away from the list and look at the general, he appeared to have stopped breathing. Manny had the deftness of a virtuoso when it came to basic tradecraft. His instinct for the street, nurtured during a childhood spent on the docks of Hoboken, honed during his back-to-back tours as chief of station in Istanbul, was on a par with his appetite for the street. It was where he felt comfortable, in his element, which is why he found himself taking certain precautions before he made the conscious decision that precautions were in order. He discovered what he was looking for in an open-air flea market behind the central food market. Scores of poverty-stricken refugees who had fled Azerbaijani pogroms were selling their belongings out of open cardboard suitcases to make ends meet. Now decked out in an old worker's cap worn low on his forehead with the peak angled over his eyes, scuffed miner's lace-up boots and an old belted raincoat that drooped to his ankles, he trailed after the broad-shouldered, broad-hipped woman with a broken, badly set nose alive with freckles. Manny had followed Benedict Bassett when he left the embassy on Thursday 2 weeks before to a workers' canteen on Krasnaya Presnya, had observed him through the window meeting the poet Zavaskaya in the back room. Afterward, Manny had followed her back to an apartment building at Rechnoy Vokzal. Acting on one of those hunches that had its roots in experience, he had decided to keep tabs on her, as opposed to him, for a week or so. Calling in sick to the embassy, he had picked her up as she left the apartment building in the morning, stayed with her through the day. There had been 2 poetry readings in factory auditoriums. There had been 6 trips to see someone in the clinic near the Kremlin. There had been a visit to the Novy Mir offices. There had been interminable hours spent queuing for food, or, once the rains started in earnest, rubbers for the young boy who had been with her the day Manny spotted Bassett and the poet at the Mayakovsky statue. Zavaskaya and Bassett had met 2 times during the week Manny followed her. On Monday in a ramshackle hostel in a workers' section on the outskirts of Moscow, where they had disappeared into a room for 2.5 hours. The 2nd time, late Thursday afternoon, in a coffee house inside the Belarusia railroad station. They met again the following Monday, this time in a vaulted basement restaurant inside the Economic Achievement Exhibition off Ostankinskaya Ulitsa. After each meeting, Zavaskaya had done precisely the same thing. She had crossed the river and had started up the hill that led to the university. Halfway up the hill, she had turned into a Stalin Gothic apartment building. The 2nd time this happened, Manny had remained near enough to hear her footsteps as she climbed to the 6th floor in stairwell C. The 3rd time, he had been following her from in front. Seeing that she was heading in the direction of the same Stalin Gothic, he had raced ahead and waited for her on the 6th floor. Concealed behind a foul-smelling plastic garbage bin, he had watched as Zavaskaya crossed into another wing of the building and started down another stairwell. Listening at the top of the stairwell, he had counted the flights as she descended. There were 3 of them before a hall door slammed closed. Sitting alone at a corner table at Sam's Lounge late Wednesday night, nursing an Alka-Seltzer set on a felt square advertising a Swedish beer, Manny retraced his steps in his head. In his mind's eye, he could see Bassett, his arm around the woman's waist, steering her with sexual urgency through the swinging front door of the hostel. He could see Bassett leaning over the small round table in the coffee house inside the Byelorussia railroad station, his head almost touching the woman's, talking intently, as if he were trying to convince her of something. He could see Bassett sitting next to her in the booth in the basement restaurant, nodding earnestly as Zavaskaya, nervously toying with a ring on her finger, rambled on. At one point, Bassett had looked around quickly. Manny could have sworn that Bassett's eyes lingered for a fleeting instant on the bearded young man with an army knapsack drinking coffee at a table near the door. Manny had noticed the same young man sitting behind the wheel of an off-duty taxi parked down the block from the hostel 3 days before. If, as Manny suspected, Bassett had spotted the KGB tail, a thin smile spread across Manny's thick lips as he considered the possibility, he had certainly not been put off by his presence. Reaching quickly into the pocket of his raincoat folded over the back of his chair, Bassett had... What? His hand had remained out of sight under the table. Had he been caressing the woman's knee or passing her something? Did she then make a beeline for what was probably a safe house on the Lennon Hills to report on what he had said, or pass on what he had given her? Had the Russians penetrated into the heart of the American embassy? Had Bassett been pressured or blackmailed or bought? Forgetting the question of motivation, was he a Soviet agent? As far as Manny could figure, there was one sure way to find out. Late Thursday afternoon, the day, according to his calculations, that Bassett was due to meet Zavaskaya again, Manny was loitering in the courtyard behind the embassy, his back to the wall of the building that housed the incinerator. He had chosen the spot for a reason. It had been constructed by the same Seabees who built the communications bubble on the sixth floor, as well as Inkerman's inner sanctum, making it the one place in the white badge area of the embassy where the Russians had not planted microphones. Even if they had, the noise from the incinerator would drown out any conversation. And Manny did not want the conversation he planned to have with Bassett overheard by the Russians. Manny had gotten rid of the wiry technician who tended the furnace and supervised the destruction of material brought down in burn bags. "Why don't you treat yourself to a long coffee break?" he told him. "I'll mind the store." Now, glancing up from his folded copy of the Paris Herald Tribune, he watched the minute hand of his wristwatch click on to 45 before the hour. He was beginning to wonder if Bassett might have canceled the usual Thursday afternoon meeting with his Russian mistress when he noticed someone pushing through a door from the embassy. Backing through the door, clutching the daily burn bag from the arms control implementation unit, one arm in his raincoat, the other struggling to find the sleeve opening, Bassett turned and came hurrying across the courtyard. The mugging went smoothly. Manny looked up from his newspaper and nodded, and Bassett, passing, nodded back. Then, in one swift motion, Manny threw a hammerlock on him and pushed him roughly through the door into the incinerator room. "What the fuck do you think?" Ben cried, his voice almost drowned out by the hiss of the incinerator. Manny's other arm pressed in on Bassett's neck, cutting off his wind and his words. Keeping a tight grip on the hammerlock, Manny eased the pressure on Bassett's windpipe. Ben gagged. He sounded as if he might vomit. Leaning forward, Manny yelled into his ear, "What I'm gonna do is pound your head into the wall and give you a headache you will remember, after which I plan to strip you stark naked and search you. You can save yourself a lot of grief, Mr. Benedict Bassett, by handing it over."
"Don't know what talking about," Ben gasped.
Manny took a grip on Bassett's hair and shoved his face into the wall. "The time for playing games is past," he announced.
"You're making a big mistake," Ben managed to get out. "What you're doing to me could ruin you."
Manny coughed up another of those guttural laughs that originated in some remote corner of his ulcer-prone stomach. His mouth close to Bassett's ear, he told him, "Hasn't anybody given you the news? This is Custer's last stand. I've been following you. I've been following the Zavaskaya lady for weeks. You've been passing stuff to her." He cranked up the hammerlock a notch. "I want it." Ben cried out in agony, "Call Inkerman!"
Manny pressed Ben's face into the wall and tightened the hammerlock another increment. Tears streamed down Ben's face. A stifled scream escaped from his mouth. Then he mumbled hoarsely, "It's taped. Leg."
"What?"
Manny yelled. "It's taped to my left leg," Bassett cried. "Whatever," Manny muttered. Keeping a grip on the hammerlock, he reached down and tugged at Bassett's trousers and peeled away the adhesive and came up with a sealed envelope thick with folded slips of paper. Snorting triumphantly, he released his grip on Bassett's arm. Ben slumped to the concrete floor. Manny inserted a thick finger in a corner of the envelope and slit it open in one motion. He pulled out the slips of paper and started to read them. "This is going to put you in a federal prison for several decades," he yelled at the figure on the floor. Ben slowly worked the arm that had been behind his back around to the front and massaged it with his other hand. "Before you make a complete fool of yourself, go get Inkerman." "What's Inkerman got to do with this?"
"For God's sake, call him. I'm part of an operation. He can confirm it. You risk ruining everything."
Manny gazed in disgust at the man crumpled on the concrete floor. He had been copying out bigot-listed messages from sensitive compartmented information cables and passing them on to the Russians. Yet, lying there on the floor, rubbing his wrist and arm, Bassett didn't look like a man who had been caught in the act. Could he be telling the truth when he claimed to be in operation? Manny yanked a wall telephone off its hook, and stabbing angrily at the numbers, dialed Inkerman's private extension. Inkerman came on the line.
"Yeah?
It's me," Manny yelled into the phone.
"So it's you. So why are you yelling? So you can hear me over the incinerator. How about you coming on down here?
Now?
Now.
Why?
I got an asshole here. Claims you can vouch for him."
Manny imagined he could hear Inkerman thinking. Then the line went dead. 4 minutes later, the door almost flew off its hinges as Inkerman burst into the incinerator room.
"This better be," he started to say.
His mouth clamped closed as he took in Bassett on the floor, sitting now with his back to the wall, his clothes disheveled, his raincoat hanging off one arm. Manny waved an envelope in Inkerman's face.
"This was taped to his leg. He's been copying out bigot-listed messages and passing them to our friends at the Komitet Государственной Безопасности," Manny yelled over the furnace. "He's a goddamn Soviet agent. Now he's saying you can vouch for him."
Inkerman's stubby fingers stabbed at the strands of hair plastered over his bald spot. "He's Army intelligence," he told the security chief. "I was under orders to give him a sealed attaché case that was brought in a sealed diplomatic pouch."
"Are you running him?"
Inkerman shrugged. "He's freelancing. I was told he could do no wrong. In our line of work, that means only one thing." Manny looked from Inkerman to Bassett and back to Inkerman. He shook his head in confusion.
"You're telling me that he's an operation.
I'm telling you to give him back the goddamn envelope and mind your own goddamn business. Go back to looking for open safes. Put your nose into the wrong place. Somebody's going to hack it off." Bassett struggled to his feet and began dusting off his clothing. He stepped forward, a length of adhesive trailing from a trouser leg, and held out a hand for the envelope. Manny stared at him in disbelief. Inkerman snickered.
"He can do no wrong," he shouted. "But you can. Give it to him, or I'll hang your balls up to dry on a clothesline."
He hiked his shoulders as if he were ready, even eager for combat. Manny hated to back down, hated the idea that someone was giving secrets to the Russians in his embassy, even if it was part of an operation. Hated the impulse to be rational when what he would have liked to do was pound Inkerman's smug smile against the concrete wall. The 24 or so times in his life he had resorted to violence, he had experienced a surge of relief. Now, feeling sick to his stomach, he muttered, "Whatever," and dropped the envelope into Bassett's outstretched hand as reluctantly as anything he had done in his professional career. Chapter 24. Manny's last bona fide binge had begun in a roadhouse near Langley, Virginia, 2 hours after his contract with the Central Intelligence Agency had been terminated, putting an end to his 16 years with the company. He had come to his senses 3 days later in a holding cell in a Norfolk, Virginia jail.
The charges against him, drunk and disorderly in a public place, lewd behavior in a public place, resisting arrest, filed by the arresting officer, one P. Duckworth, who had picked him out of the gutter behind an all-night bar in Virginia Beach, had included excerpts from Manny's drunken ravings, did menace the life of one Charles Inkman, whereabouts unknown, whose subject claimed was responsible for his being unjustly fired from an unnamed company in that he threatened to inject said Charles Inkman with monkey gland extract, which contains adrenaline-like chemicals that cause blood pressure to shoot up and result in a brain hemorrhage and death, or alternately, force said Charles Inkman to drink a quantity of ethyl alcohol, the temperature of which had been lowered to 50 degrees below freezing, which results in the victim's insides freezing and death. The subject repeatedly boasted that using either of these methods, only the most experienced medical examiner would turn up evidence of foul play. Several of Manny's company friends had gotten wind of the arrest. Flashing CIA credentials and mumbling about national security, they had convinced a local magistrate that Manny should be released in their recognizance. Now, holed up in his Moscow apartment, Manny decided the time had come to purify his sinking spirits with a new binge. Kicking off his shoes, he lined up 3 bottles of cheap scotch on the folding bridge table next to the sofa. "Well, well, what have we here?" he said under his breath. Carefully filling a glass, he held it up to toast an imaginary drinking partner. "Here's mud or whatever in your eye," he grumbled, and flinging back his head, he drained the glass. Wiping his lips with the back of his hand, he refilled the glass and raised it in a new toast. "Here's to the miraculous power of alcohol to drown affronts, slights, insults to your intelligence, indignities, humiliations, assaults on your honor. Whatever," he announced. And belching, he drained the second glass. "Ah, this is getting serious," he told himself. Forming the fingers of his right hand into a pistol, he squinted along the barrel at one of the 3 bottles of scotch and pulled an imaginary trigger. "Bang! Bang! You're anesthetized," he mumbled. He filled the glass again with a shaky hand and held it aloft. Scotch dripped onto his trousers. "Ah! Don't want to waste any of this precious, soon-to-be bodily fluid, do I? Here's to monkey gland extract and ethyl alcohol and whatever." He drank off the contents of the glass, then breathed deeply through his nostrils for several minutes. The world around him was beginning to blur. He felt the sofa move under him and began swaying from side to side to match the motion. He was on a boat, he decided, dragging anchor, pleasantly adrift in an alcoholic haze. Somehow he found himself raising another filled glass in toast. The scotch in it slopped from side to side. Some of it spilled on the floor, but he didn't care anymore. "Here's to the last of the cunts," he declared. "Yours truly, Emmanuel Custer, obsessed by the banality of evil, or whatever." He had difficulty closing the gap between the glass and his mouth. Wrapping both of his large hands around the glass, he managed the feat and drained off another glass of scotch without rocks. The binge, he sensed, had gotten off to a reasonable start. He drifted to the surface, arriving in the pitch darkness of a Moscow night. There was a jackhammer working, which, considering the hours, surprised him until he figured out it was hammering away in his temple. Stumbling into the bathroom, he groped for a light switch, squinted in pain when the bulb came on. He found a jar of aspirins and spilled several into a wet palm and swallowed them. He found a clock and stared at it until it came into focus, trying to figure out why it did not say what day it was. He got his first clue of how long the binge had lasted when he spotted himself in the medicine chest mirror. His gray face had a 2-day growth of gray beard on it. Peeling off his clothing, he maneuvered himself under the shower head and turned on the faucet. At first, nothing happened. Then the plumbing screamed. Then rusty ice water trickled out. The trickle grew into a jet, and he let it play over his hair and face and body. It was under the shower that the word came back to him. He heard it inside his head. Iron. Iron whatever.
Ironweed. Of course, ironweed. That was what had been written on the slips of paper he had pulled from the envelope taped to Bassett's leg. Wrapped in a terrycloth bathrobe, Manny set a pot of coffee to brewing on the stove while he shaved. Settling onto a high kitchen stool, he lined up 5 cups and filled each one with scalding coffee. He started blowing on the first one to bring the temperature down to where it was drinkable. Words drifted into his consciousness. Iron. Weed. Ironweed. A snatch of text from the slips of paper came to him. Ironweed dead drop message reports that Andropov's health seriously deteriorating, maneuvering for succession already begun. Which meant Ironweed was the code name of a person rather than an operation. If Ironweed knew that the health of Andropov, then the Secretary General of the Communist Party, was deteriorating, it meant he was important enough to have access to this kind of information. It might even mean he was one of those involved in the maneuvering. But assuming that the company had a sleeper high in the Soviet superstructure, why was our side slipping his messages to the Soviet side? The Cold War and its attendant intelligence operations were winding down, so the world thought, so the newspapers said, but the American side was obviously still playing by the old rules. Another snatch of message came to him. Ksenia, Manny remembered it saying, must be added to the doomsday list. Who was Ksenia? And what was a doomsday list? By the time he had finished the 5th cup of coffee, he had made up his mind. Better go out with a bang than a whimper, he thought. Pulling on some clean clothing, he grabbed his car keys and headed for the parking lot. If the 2 Marines on duty were surprised to see the security officer turn up at the embassy at 3:30 in the morning, the circles under his eyes as dark as bruises, his scowling face full of nicks where he had cut himself shaving, they masked it behind boyishly crisp nods. Manny made his way to his cubbyhole of an office. He had trouble opening his safe, had to try 6 variations of the combination before one worked. Pushing aside embassy security records and several new pairs of sweat socks, he retrieved a small wooden file box and began flipping through the cards until he found the one he wanted. Slipping it into his jacket pocket, he made his way to the 9th floor, where he found the Marine on duty sitting alertly behind the table. "Your friends at the main entrance must have phoned up that I was in the building," Manny commented. "What makes you say that, sir?" the Marine asked with a straight face. "Seeing you awake at this ungodly hour is what makes me say that. Whatever." Manny scratched his name in the logbook and, under reason for visit to the embassy's green badge area, wrote, "Surprise Security Inspection of Restricted Spaces." Then he walked up 1 flight to the 10th floor and made his way down the hall, past the defense attaché's offices, past the deputy chief of missions office, to a door with only a number on it. To the right of the door was a small box and a blinking red light. Manny pulled the file card from his pocket, noted the door code, and punched it into the box. The red dial stopped blinking. He turned the knob and pushed open the door to the CIA station. Flicking on a desk lamp, Manny glanced around. He noticed a collection of lipsticks on Miss Macy's desk next to an unsigned inter-office memo on which was typed, "Your place or mine." Snickering, Manny made his way to the door of the ribbon room, checked his file card again, then punched a number into the electronic door lock. The door to the ribbon room clicked open. Just inside the door, Manny found a light switch. 2 lamps, one on the small desk, one on a box of ribbons, came on. He walked over and crouched in front of the safe. He tried twirling the combination lock, but it spun freely. He noted the combination written on his file card and rotated the dial past 0 to 33, then back past 33 to 7, then to 11. He felt the dial catch. He pushed on the handle. The door swung open. Reaching up, Manny angled the desk lamps so that it illuminated the interior of the safe. Turning back, he memorized the position of a thin notebook on a shelf in the safe, then took it out. Settling down at the desk that Bassett worked at, He adjusted the lamp and opened the book. On the inside cover, someone had written in ink, "In the event this book falls into the hands of anyone other than Benedict Bassett, it should be sealed, labeled, top secret, eyes only, and expedited by special diplomatic pouch addressed to Intelligence Support Activity, Pentagon, Washington, D.C. Attention, Marlowe." Manny looked up. He had never heard of anything called an Intelligence Support Activity, but that, of course, did not mean much. He pulled a sheet of white bond typing paper folded into quarters from his jacket pocket and copied off the reference to an Intelligence Support Activity and Marlowe. Then he went back to the thin book and began working his way through its pages. The book seemed to be divided into two parts. The first was labeled, in the same handwriting as the note on the inside cover, Silverweed. The second part was labeled Ironweed. The Silverweed section was much thinner than the Ironweed section. Hunched over the desk, Manny read through the pages of the notebook, pausing from time to time to scribble notes to himself on his sheet of bond paper. There appeared to be extracts from 8 messages concerning Silverweed. The gist of them was that Silverweed was planning to visit Moscow in 1967 and proposed recruiting someone he knew from his university days who held a grudge against the party because of something that had happened to a close childhood friend who was a Kalmyk. A second meeting between Silverweed and Ironweed took place in Prague in the fall of 1969. A third in Brussels, at an unspecified date. There was a fourth meeting, again the date unspecified, at a KGB sanatorium on the Black Sea. Turning to the Ironweed section of the notebook, Manny skimmed the material on dead drops and addresses in Europe, where messages could be sent activating the dead drops. Another of the messages caught Manny's eye. Ironweed was asking if his handlers could get his wife and child out of Russia in case he was in danger of being caught. 2 words leapt out of the notebook. Ironweed referred to his doomsday list. Manny looked up, his face in the shadows, his eyes wide open in discovery. He was remembering what he had seen on one of the slips of paper in the envelope he had found taped to Bassett's leg. Xenia, it had said, must be added to the doomsday list. Manny licked the ball of his thumb and rifled through the pages until he found what he was looking for. It was an entry dated March, 1973. Ironweed dead drop message insists Xenia must be added to the doomsday list. Manny picked up reading where he had left off and continued scribbling on his sheet of bond paper. He recorded the story about Ironweed repairing a tractor motor, caught the reference that indicated Silverweed was female, made a note of Ironweed's visit to West Germany in 1975, plunged on through the pages, reading and rereading the handwritten entries and extracting the pertinent details, places, dates, names. When he reached the last entry in the thin book, he jotted on his paper, "Messages break off in 1985," and wrote the word, "Why?" Back in his cubbyhole of an office, Manny locked the door on the inside and flung his jacket over the back of a chair and settled down at his own desk to read over the notes he had made. After a while, he pulled another sheet of paper from a drawer and began to write. Item: Bassett's assignment as a housekeeper for the 7 Dwarfs was a cover. On the surface, he seems to have been turned into a penetration agent by the KGB, but he is an operation. He isn't delivering ciphers or deciphered messages to his KGB handlers. He is simply copying off items from a thin notebook in his safe on scraps of paper and passing them to the Russians as if they were messages. Item: Bassett is slipping information to the Russians that would tip them to the fact that the Americans were running a high-level agent in place recruited in 1967. Contact with the agent was broken off in 1985. The messages Bassett slipped to the Russians covering the years between 1967 and 1985 were seeded with references to places and people, almost as if... Manny looked up. Almost, he thought, as if the Americans were trying to narrow the list for the KGB.
almost as if they wanted the KGB to identify and punish the traitor. The key to identifying the agent in place, Manny's instincts told him, was the fact that the operation had broken off in 1985. Why? He asked out loud. Then he bent his head and spelled out the possible answers. Item. Ironweed died. Unlikely. If dead, why bother betraying him now? Item. Ironweed chickened out. Unlikely. Knowing my colleagues at the company, they would threaten to betray him and those on his doomsday list to the Russians unless he kept nose to grindstone. Item. Ironweed became too important to run like an ordinary agent. Completely baffled, Manny stared out over the lamp into the darkness. He remembered another of the scraps of paper he had seen in Bassett's envelope. Turning to the notes he had scribbled on the folded sheet of bond paper, he studied the original entry he had copied out of the thin book. Ironweed dead drop message reports that Andropov's health seriously deteriorating. Maneuvering for succession already begun. He stared at the words, shook his head, shrugged a heavy shoulder, tapped the point of his pen on the paper. How would Ironweed know the state of Andropov's health unless he, Ironweed, was a ranking member of the party? Could Ironweed himself have been one of those maneuvering for the succession? Manny's thoughts again came full circle. If Ironweed was important enough to know Andropov, to maneuver for the succession, why was he being betrayed? If it served American interests to betray him, why betray him now? And why, in order to betray Ironweed, did Bassett have to copy handwritten messages out of the thin notebook that had been smuggled into the country in a sealed diplomatic pouch? Why didn't he copy the original messages? Were there original messages to copy? Did Ironweed really exist, or was he a fragment of someone's Machiavellian imagination? The answers to the riddle would fall into place, Manny suspected, if he could identify Ironweed. His eye fell on the reference to an intelligence support activity, Pentagon, Washington, D.C., attention, Marlowe. He would get an enciphered message off to an old friend of his who worked for the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, a former CIA officer who, like him, had been kicked out of the company when his ideas clashed with the conventional wisdom of the in-house pessimists. Manny would ask him if he had ever heard of an intelligence support activity, or someone named Marlowe. While he was waiting for the reply, he would pore over the State Department biographies of Soviet leaders on his shelf. He would see if he could come up with someone who had been to Prague in 1967, to Brussels sometime in his life, to West Germany in 1975, to Canada in 1983, to England in 1984, to Paris in 1985, where, according to the last messages in the thin notebook, he discreetly laid flowers on the grave of someone. In addition, Ironweed would have a wife and a child, and someone named Xenia, to whom he felt close enough that he asked the CIA to add her name to his doomsday list. His background would have equipped him to repair the motor of a tractor, and he was probably promoted to an important party post in 1985. Doodling on his sheet of typing paper, Manny wrote, Item, Silverweed, working for the CIA, recruits Ironweed. Bassett, working for who? Betrays Ironweed. Where is the thread of logic? Whatever. Filipov, who had buried himself in the KGB's dusty archives for 3 straight days, came prancing into Glyabova's windowless office with the news. Glyabova, with Filipov trailing in her wake, swooped through the halls, her stiletto heels dispatching staccato echoes from its walls to the old general, who listened to what she had to say, then asked her to repeat it twice before picking up the telephone to summon Viktor. My analysts have narrowed the list of 23 Ironweeds down to 12, the general told Viktor when he arrived, out of breath from having taken the stairs 2 at a time. Both elevators were out of order. Filipov, Glyabova announced, sucking air through her nostrils after each noun to underscore the importance of what she was saying, has been prying Xenia's out of the woodwork. I found one grandmother, one mother, three sisters, two daughters, one granddaughter, one ex-wife, and three mistresses with the name Xenia, Filipov triumphantly explained. The general handed the typewritten list of 12 possible ironweeds to Viktor. Once again, he appeared to suspend breathing as he read it. Looking up, he reached into his pocket and pulled out the latest envelope thick with folded slips of paper. "We are approaching the denouement," he declared huskily. "There are three messages in this batch that are particularly relevant. Ironweed was in Canada in 1983 and England in 1984. He met secretly with Silverweed on both occasions. In 1985, just before contact with him was broken off, he was in Paris. His CIA handlers were appalled to discover that he had visited a grave in Paris. His French hosts were left with the impression that someone he had known from his days at university had died in a Paris hospital. Ironweed stopped to buy a bouquet of chrysanthemums before wandering alone into Père Lachaise Cemetery. For a moment, no one spoke. Then Gliobova asked in a breathless voice, "What month was that?" Viktor went through the slips in the envelope, unfolding each until he found the one he was looking for. "It was in October of 1985, he replied. Filipov drew himself up so that he was standing at attention, his fists pressed against his sides, his chin jutting. The woman who was Dubček's speechwriter, Ilkiv, died of a burst appendix in a Paris hospital in October of 1985. Gliobova, looking like a ship of state, navigated across the carpet and docked at the general's enormous desk. "There is a question that must be asked," she declared. The general nodded. "Four of the names on our short list are in the stratosphere of our superstructure. Should our list narrow to one of these four?" Gliobova was uncertain how to put her question. "What I mean is, if Ironweed turns out to be someone of extreme importance, can my colleague and I count on your protection?" Viktor and the old general exchanged looks. The general heaved himself to his feet and contemplated Gliobova across the desk. Because she was the taller of the two, his head was angled up. "In the 18 years you have worked for me, have you ever known me to throw someone to the wolves?" Gliobova shook her head. "Never, but..." "There is no but. You and your colleague will follow where the trail leads. We will deal with the consequences." Gliobova turned toward the door. "You will have to excuse us," she said gravely. "We have work to do." Followed by Filipov, she plunged from the old general's corner office, headed for the dusty archives, and the solution to the ironweed puzzle. Chapter 25. Aida would have been the first to admit that Vadim, her ex-husband and guardian angel, had his faults, but forgetting birthdays had never been one of them. For Aida's 42nd, he came up with an apartment where she could spend 2 nights running with her American lover. Located on the 6th floor of a dilapidated building behind the puppet theater on the peripheral boulevard, it belonged to a retired Jewish doctor who had gone off to take a mud bath cure at a spa on the Black Sea. Ben arrived at the apartment with French bleu d'Auvergne, and Swedish crackers, and fresh fruit, and 2 bottles of a relatively disappointing year of an excellent French Bordeaux named Montalbert, all bought at the diplomatic gastronome. The apartment had 4 small dingy rooms and a kitchen with patches of linoleum peeling from the floor and a windowless bathroom with a toilet that never stopped running, but every inch of every wall and both sides of every door were covered with Russian paintings from the 20s and 30s. The Jewish doctor and his late wife had started the collection, Aida explained, to celebrate the death of Stalin in 1953. The rooms were filled with canvases painted by Falk before his Paris period, still lifes by Weissmann, landscapes by Konchalevsky, various paintings by Altmann and Pasternak Pair, and a portrait of Lili Brick, tossed off by Mayakovsky between extravagant poems glorifying the Bolshevik Revolution. "You are looking at what Russian art could have become," Aida said with a sad smile, "if it had not been strangled by socialist realism. It is a wonderful place to make love, don't you think?" Ben eagerly agreed. They nibbled at the food and sipped the wine, and made love, and prowled naked through the rooms gazing at the paintings, and made love again. Both seemed to put behind them the tensions of the past few weeks. Before sinking into a deep, dreamless sleep, Aida whispered, "It has not been this good between us since the train to Leningrad." Entangled in each other's arms in the early hours of the morning, they were roused by the sound of trucks from the collectives around Moscow hauling food to market. Aida tried to kiss Ben, but he turned his head away. "So, do the trucks remind you there is a real world outside our private world?" Ben propped himself up in the bed. Something was obviously bothering him. "You told me I was in love with you before I knew it myself," he reminded her. "Whatever happens to us from here on, I want you to know that it is true. I do love you. God knows I didn't plan to fall in love. God knows I didn't think I could fall in love." The words spilled out with the same intensity with which Ben, a lifetime back, had told Aida, "I hope to Christ we do not meet again. I bitterly regret getting you into this mess." Startled by the burst of emotion, Aida interrupted, "Dear heart, it was not your..." But Ben rushed on. "I am going to get Sava that operation," he vowed. Aida, annoyed with him for breaking the spell, reacted angrily. "How?" she challenged. "Espionage is a delicate game," Ben said. "Relationships depend on who has more to gain or lose at any given moment. Up to now, I had more to lose by not doing what they wanted. I could lose you, and you could lose the boy, and they knew it and used it. But that has all changed. We have reached a point where Victor, or whatever his name really is, has more to lose than I do." Aida was regarding Ben strangely. "How do you know such things?" "I figured it out." "What does Victor have to lose?" Ben was thinking out loud now. "The information I stole from the embassy is valuable to him only so long as the Americans don't know the Russians have it. This gives me a card to play." "I do not follow what you are saying." "It doesn't matter whether you understand." Springing from the bed, Ben crossed the room and pulled an envelope out of the pocket of his sports jacket. "This is the last envelope you will have to give them," he announced as he dropped it in her hand. "They will not believe there is no more information," she said worriedly. "They will cut Sava's dosage again." "They will believe it when I tell them. When you give them the envelope, organize another meeting for me in the safe house, Thursday, at 7 in the evening. So, if I permitted myself to believe you have a card to play, it would only raise my hopes, and raised hopes can only end in disappointment." The bittersweet half-smile appeared on Aida's soft lips. "The truth is that I have more or less grown accustomed to living without hope. I take nothing for granted. Not you in my bed, not Sava's medicine in my hand, not even the sun rising in the morning. I must feel its heat on my skin before I permit myself to believe it is there." "This time, you will not be disappointed," Ben whispered. He pulled her into his arms. "I love you," he said, discovering it, savoring it, believing it. They were drinking instant coffee in the kitchen later that morning when they heard the knock at the front door. "Who knows we are here?" Ben asked quickly. "Only Vadim." Aida got up and called through the door. "Yes? Zinaida Ivanovna?" Aida recognized the voice of Vadim's taxi driver, Dmitri. She pulled open the door. Dmitri, a round man who looked as if he might have been a monk at some point in his life, smiled nervously. "It's about your father," he said mournfully. "Vadim said for me to bring you straight off to the hospital." Ben came up behind her. "I will go with you." Aida pulled a shawl over her shoulders. "It is better if we are not seen together," she said. She took his hand and lifted the back of it to her lips and kissed it, letting her tongue play quickly over his knuckles. Then she turned away and followed Dmitri. At the clinic, Aida found her father struggling feebly in his large metal bed to kick the tattered quilt off his legs. His eyes had almost disappeared into his gaunt face in the last few days. He looked at Aida without recognizing her. "Come on, come on, damn it," he called, weakly waving his crushed, nailless fingers. Aida massaged his calves, and this seemed to calm him. His head sank back into the pillow. His eyes closed.
He breathed heavily through caked lips. An old woman wearing a pink bathrobe hobbled past the open door on two canes. She stopped to peer into the room. "How did he get like this?" she demanded in disgust. "Old age," Aida replied. "That's no excuse," the old woman shot back, and turning, hobbled on down the corridor. Aida's father tossed in the bed, babbling under his breath. "Books," he repeated again and again. "Books." When his eyes opened, she stroked his forehead. "Don't be frightened, father." "Not frightened," he said very clearly. "Then, know who enemy is. Fighting, not frightened." These turned out to be his last distinguishable words. Kicking weakly at the quilt, playing with his penis, breathing with labored irregularity through his mouth, he sank into a shallow coma. The woman doctor, a stump of a cigarette glued to her lower lip, came into the room. She took his pulse, then gripped his hand. "Hello, Ivan! Do you hear me?" she called. "If you hear me, squeeze my fingers." When Aida's father did not respond, the doctor examined his mutilated fingers, shook her head in pity, and let his hand drop back onto the quilt. "It is almost the end," she informed Aida. She touched her on the shoulder, one woman comforting another. "Holler if you need help," she said as she left. Aida reached for her father's hand. "Father, it's me, Zinaida," she said quietly. The old man's eyes suddenly flicked wide open. Aida forced herself to smile into them until her father's lids drifted closed over his eyes. Some minutes later, she detected a distinct rattle in the back of his throat each time he breathed. With infinite gradualness, his breathing became shallower. Finally, it was reduced to tiny gasps. The old man's features relaxed, his mouth, open until then sagged, closed. His eyes slowly opened and stared at the ceiling, unseeing. Then, magically, he just stopped breathing. After 15 seconds, he took another weak gasp, then a third. Then he did not breathe again. "You did it," Aida said softly. Still clinging to his hand, she reached up and pressed the lids closed over his eyes and kissed his forehead, and then sat back to memorize the dying. Aida's father had been fitted into a shallow open pine coffin that rested now on two chairs in a makeshift holding room on the first floor of the clinic. The window shades had been drawn. A scratchy rendition of some unidentifiable funeral music was being piped over a single speaker set on a chair in a corner. The old man in the coffin had been dressed in his uniform tunic and trousers. His medals had been laid in rows on a small crimson cushion placed on his chest. There had been a fixed forfeit for the funeral that included the casket and the cushion and the hearse and the taped music and the wreath, and finally, burial in a plot set aside for veterans of the Great Patriotic War. Candles had been extra, and Aida had decided to do without them. At the last minute, Vadim had turned up with 2 dozen church wafers. The flickering yellowish light from the candles made the old man's skin look wax-like. Aida started to blow out the candles, but Vadim, arguing that candles were traditional, pulled her back to her chair. Sitting next to Aida on one of the folding chairs set up in rows, Sava quietly sobbed his heart out. Vadim leaned toward Aida. "You might try crying, too. Think of it as therapeutic." Aida only fingered Akhmatova's agate ring and stared at the coffin. Aida and Sava and Vadim piled into Vadim's taxi to follow the hearse to the cemetery. The lid was nailed onto the coffin, and the coffin lowered on worn ropes into a freshly dug hole in the ground. Aida and then Sava picked up a handful of dirt and dropped it onto the coffin. Vadim distributed generous tips to the gravediggers and signaled with a forefinger for his taxi to approach. Aida passed up the offer of a ride home in the taxi, preferring instead to walk back to town with Sava. They walked for a long while on a sidewalk that ran parallel to a wide pitted boulevard. Sava eventually broke the silence. "It must have been the Cossacks who finally got Granddad." Aida nodded. "He told me once that we were the Cossacks," Sava said. What did he mean?
A militia truck, painted dirty yellow with a blue stripe, the blue light on top blinking frantically, sped past. So, I think it was his way of saying that the enemy is inside us. I don't get it. How can an enemy be inside someone? Like many of his generation, your grandfather took the habit of having an enemy early in his life. It answered a deep need, I suppose. When he was confronted with the possibility that there were no more enemies, he became the enemy. How is it possible to become your own enemy? It is difficult to explain to someone who has not lived through what your grandfather lived through. Every time I ask you something, you say it is difficult to explain. So, if it were not difficult to explain, you would not be asking. That is true. Saba slipped his hand into Aida's. When I think of grandfather, I picture him sitting by the window through the night. Did he ever not sit by the window through the night? Long ago, she said, before he became afraid, he did not sit by the window through the night. And she added, very softly, where he is now, he surely does not have to sit by the window through the night. Glebova turned ashen when N. Filipov showed her the deciphered cable from Prague. She collapsed into the nearest chair to reread it. This is the final piece of the puzzle, she whispered. Now there can be no doubt. Filipov's bushy eyebrows twitched nervously. Who in his wildest flights of imagination would have suspected such a denouement, he muttered. Glebova brought a hand to her breast. My heart is beating so rapidly it is going to burst. She looked at Filipov, who was gazing out a window, absorbed in his thoughts, then reached for the telephone and dialed an in-house number. I must speak with the general, she insisted shrilly. No, no, at once. I will take the responsibility. He will want you to break in on the conference. Glebova kept the phone pressed to her ear. There was a long pause. Then she cupped a hand around the mouthpiece, as if the precaution would render the conversation more secure, and breathed into it. General, Glebova here, I am calling to tell you that the list has been narrowed to one. Both Viktor and the general were standing when Glebova, followed closely by Filipov, arrived at the general's office. The fingers of the general's bad hand contracted, beckoning Glebova. She stepped forward almost reluctantly and held out a typewritten sheet of paper. The general and Viktor avoided each other's eye. The general reached out with his good hand and accepted the paper. Viktor read it over the general's shoulder. 12 names had been typed on it. 11 of them had been crossed out. Viktor was the first to regain his composure. Are you 100% sure? Filipov poked at an imaginary spot of dirt under a fingernail. One can never be 100% sure, but we are 99.9% sure. Remember how Ironweed repaired that tractor? The name on your list was born in the village of Privolnoye in the Stavropol Krai. He was the son of peasants driven onto a collective farm during Stalin's forced collectivization of agriculture in the early 1930s. Thus, he would have had a grudge against Soviet power and a motive to betray it. In 1943, at the age of 12, he worked as a combine operator at a tractor station. His best friend at the time was a Kalmyk, who was subsequently deported to Siberia as part of a program to punish the Kalmyks because some of them collaborated with the German invaders. The man whose name is not crossed out has a wife and child. In 1973, when Ironweed added the name Ksenia to his doomsday list, his daughter had a daughter named Ksenia. Shrugging delicately, Filipov gestured with his chin toward the list in the general's hand. He was a protege of Andropov and was regularly invited to confer with him at the KGB spa on the Black Sea. Ironweed met Silverweed in Canada in 1983 and in England in 1984. Again, Filipov gestured toward the list. He was in Canada in 1983 and in England in 1984. The CIA broke off contact with Ironweed in 1985, the year he... Filipov's forefinger, pointing at the single name on the paper not crossed out, trembled, was promoted to his preeminent position. Glebova's hand found its way to her breast again. We have connected Silverweed to Ironweed, she solemnly announced, her moist eyes bulging, her breath coming in short gasps. You recall the connection between Ironweed and the Dubček speechwriter named Martina Ilkif? Ilkif turned out to be her married name. Her maiden name was Dzur. There is a record of a Martina Dzur having attended the law faculty of Moscow State University when he was a student there. On her dossier, there is even a credit for a course on economic logic taught by the famous Professor Usov. Like Filipov, Glebova was pointing at the name on the paper in the general's hand. Like Filipov, her finger was trembling. He attended the same class. We located two of her classmates who remembered that the young Czech communist named Dzur had fallen in love with him, and for a time moved in with him. When the Ilkiev woman died in Paris in 1985 of a burst appendix, she was buried in Père Lachaise Cemetery. 3 days before his CIA handlers spotted him wandering into the cemetery with a bouquet of chrysanthemums. One can even surmise that it was this blunder that pushed the CIA to break contact with him. The general painstakingly folded the sheet of paper in half, and then in half again, and slipped it into his jacket pocket. His eyes clouded over as he slowly made his way to his desk and sat down behind it. I want you to bring me your worksheets, your archives, your documents, your dossiers, your queries, and the replies, everything associated with this case, he said huskily. You are not to breathe a word of this to a living soul. Take some time off. Do not leave Moscow. Make sure my office knows where to reach you at all times. The old general raised his chin and squinted at a painting depicting Lenin's arrival at the Finland station. When he spoke again, his voice seemed to echo through the room. Know that you have done your country an extraordinary service. Glebova glanced at Filipov, then backed toward the door. Filipov lingered as if something more needed to be said. Thinking better of it, he followed her out of the office. Viktor unbuttoned his jacket and settled heavily onto a chair next to the general's desk. The general pulled open a drawer and produced two small glasses and a bottle and a covered tin. He undid the lid and pushed the tin across the desk toward Viktor, who leaned forward, selected a dried apricot, and began eating it. The general filled the two small glasses and handed one to Viktor. Cherry brandy, Georgian, clear away the cobwebs. He nibbled at a dried apricot, brought his glass of brandy to his nose to smell it, then tilted back his head and drained off the brandy. Viktor followed suit. The alcohol seared their throats. Both men opened their mouths and exhaled deeply. The general began filling the two glasses again. Where is my daughter these days? She is filming a television series. You are a patient man, Viktor. I have always appreciated that trait in you. You have the quality essential in a good hunter, the ability to wait before going in for the kill. I admire that in a man. He passed the filled glass back to Viktor and raised his in thoughtful toast. Let us drink to Pamyat and going in for the kill. Viktor repeated, to Pamyat and going in for the kill, and seared his throat a second time. Chapter 26. The pieces resisted falling into place for 2 days and three nights. Sometime after midnight, on the third night, Manny ran out of scotch and rocks and stamina, and despaired of finding an answer. He had come across too many Xenias, too many people who had one wife and one daughter, too many who had been to the places Ironweed had been to at roughly the time Ironweed had been there, too many who had changed jobs in 1985 to do more than narrow the list of suspects. His head reeling with fatigue, he slumped back in his chair, his hands clasped behind his neck, to contemplate the slips of paper jutting from the pages of the State Department biographies of Soviet leaders heaped on his desk. The sight stirred a memory. Manny's desk had been heaped with State Department biographies back in 1979 when he had prepared the written assessment of a new candidate member of the Politburo for his then-boss, Charlie Inkerman. Slips of paper had jutted from the pages. Manny recalled that two of the slips had marked passages that seemed pertinent now. Item. The subject of the 1979 written assessment had been born in the village of Privolnoye in the Stavropol Krai at the height of Stalin's ruthless program of collectivization in 1931. Sensing for the first time that he was onto something, Manny leaned forward and flipped through the pages of a State Department geography manual. He soon found what he was looking for. There had been Kalmyks living in a settlement 30 miles from Privolnaya. They had been deported en masse to Siberia in December 1943. Something else occurred to Manny. He reached for a State Department biography, moistened the ball of his thick thumb, and skimmed through the pages until he found the reference. The subject had been raised on a collective farm and sent to work on a tractor station at the age of 12 to replace the men who were off at war. He would have known how to repair a tractor motor, and he could easily have had a friend who was a Kalmyk. Item. Manny's 1979 assessment for Inkerman, which had gotten him fired from the CIA when he refused to water it down, had called attention to an odd coincidence. The new candidate member of the Politburo had had a Czech intellectual for a mistress during 3 of the 5 years he attended the law faculty of Moscow State University. Manny's assessment had concluded that some of the radical ideas of the young woman, who later became a speechwriter for Alexander Dubček during the Prague Spring of 1968, would have had to rub off on the Soviet hick. A Czech mistress who later became a speechwriter for Alexander Dubček during the Prague Spring. The pieces were falling into place. According to one of the messages Benedict Bassett had passed to the Russians, Silverweed was a woman. Could Dubček's speechwriter be Silverweed? Could she have recruited her classmate and lover from Moscow State University to work for the CIA? Manny's eyes glazed over with elation. He had narrowed the list of suspects to one. Meticulous to a fault, he went over the whole thing again, item by item. His prime suspect was the son of peasants who were forced onto a collective in the early 1930s, which meant he would have been raised in an atmosphere that was profoundly anti-Soviet. So much for motive. Ironweed had been to Prague in 1967, to Brussels sometime in his life, to West Germany in 1975, to Canada in 1983, to England in 1984, to Paris in 1985. Ditto for the prime suspect. One wife, one child. Xenia. Access to Andropov. The friend who was a Kalmyk. The ability to repair a tractor motor, his connection to Prague and Silverweed, a promotion of importance in 1985 that might have obliged the CIA to break off contact. Peering through a haze of fatigue and incredulity, Manny realized he had come unwillingly, grudgingly, to the only conclusion possible. The question was, what to do about it? Pushing through the crowd of tourists and businessmen at the door, Manny waved a $10 bill at the grinning Georgian with a pin on his lapel that read, Maître d'hôtel. I reserved, Manny shouted over the balalaika music and the din. Custer, Emmanuel, from the American Embassy. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.